your effort to hurry back and help me out. Since then, Dad's fallen off the cruise ship and been pulled out of icy water with a broken arm, a dislocated shoulder, a detached retina, short-term memory loss, and possibly a mild stroke. He and Mom have been helicoptered to New Brunswick. I've been fired from the best job I may ever have, and Gary and I have learned about a new medical technology that I feel certain you would agree is horrifying and dystopic and malignant, except that it's good for Parkinson's and can maybe help Dad. Other than that, not much to report. Hope all's well wherever the fuck you are. Julia says Lithuania and expects me to believe it. From xprof@gadisfly.com to denise3@cheapnet.com, subject, let's maybe try a little harder next time. Business opportunity in Lithuania. Julia's husband, Gitanas, is paying me to produce a profit-making website. It's actually a lot of fun and not unlucrative. All your favorite high school groups are on the radio here. Smiths, New Order, Billy Idol. A blast from the past. I saw an old man kill a horse with a shotgun on a street near the airport. I'd been on Baltic soil for maybe 15 minutes. Welcome to Lithuania. Talked to Mom this morning, got the whole story, made my apologies, so don't worry about that. I'm sorry about your job. To be honest, I'm stunned. I can't believe anyone would fire you. Where are you working now? From denise3@cheapnet.com to xprof@gadisfly.com, subject, holiday responsibilities. Mom says you won't commit to coming home for Christmas, and she expects me to believe it, but I'm thinking no way could you talk to a woman who's just had the highlight of her year truncated by an accident and who otherwise has a shitty life with a semi-disabled man and who hasn't gotten to be at home for Christmas since like Dan Quayle's vice presidency and who survives by looking forward to things and who loves Christmas the way other people love sex and who's seen you for all of 45 minutes in the last 3 years. I'm thinking no way could you have told this woman, nope, sorry, staying in Vilnius. Vilnius? Mom must have misunderstood you. Please clarify. Since you ask, I'm not working anywhere, subbing a little at Mare Scuro, but otherwise sleeping until 2 in the afternoon. If this continues, I may have to do some therapeutic thing of the sort that will horrify you. Got to regain my appetite for shopping and other non-free consumer pleasures. The last thing I heard about Gitanas Misevičius was that he'd given Julia 2 black eyes, but whatever. From xprof@gadisfly.com to denise3@cheapnet.com, subject, holiday responsibilities. I intend to get to St. Jude as soon as I make some money, maybe even by Dad's birthday, but Christmas is hell, you know that. There's no worse time. You can tell Mom I'll come early in the new year. Mom says that Caroline and the boys will be in St. Jude for Christmas. Can this be true? Don't not take a psychotropic on my account. From denise3@cheapnet.com to xprof@gadisfly.com, subject, the only thing I hurt was my dignity. Nice try, but no, sorry, I insist that you come for Christmas. I've been talking to Axon, and the plan is to give Dad 6 months of Correctol, beginning right after New Year's, and to let him and Mom stay with me while that's going on. Helpfully, my life is in ruins, so it's easy to make myself available. The only way this scenario won't happen is if Axon's medical staff decides that Dad has non-drug-related dementia. He admittedly seemed pretty shaky when he was in New York, but he's been sounding good on the phone. All I hurt when I fell was my dignity, etc. They took the cast off his arm a week early. Anyway, he's probably going to be with me in Philly for his birthday and for the rest of the winter and spring, too, and so Christmas is the time for you to come to St. Jude, and so please don't argue with me anymore, just do it. I eagerly, but with confidence, await confirmation that you will be there. P.S. Caroline, Aaron, and Caleb are not coming. Gary's coming with Jonah and flying back to Philly at noon on the 25th. P.P.S. Don't worry, I say no to drugs. From xprof@gadisfly.com to denise3@cheapnet.com, subject, the only thing I hurt was my dignity. I saw a man shot 6 times in the stomach last night, a paid hit in a club called Musmirite. It had nothing to do with us, but I wasn't happy to see it. It's not clear to me why I'm required to come to St. Jude on some specific date. If Mom and Dad were my children, whom I'd created out of nothing without asking their permission, I could understand being responsible for them. Parents have an overwhelming Darwinian, hardwired genetic stake in their children's welfare. But children, it seems to me, have no corresponding debt to their parents. Basically, I have very little to say to these people, and I don't think they want to hear what I do have to say. Why don't I plan to see them when they're in Philadelphia? That sounds more fun anyway. That way all nine of us can get together instead of just six of us. From Denise3 at cheapnet.com to xprof@gaddisfly.com, subject, a serious flaming from your pissed-off sister. My God, you sound self-pitying. I'm saying come for my sake, and also for your own sake, because I'm sure it's very cool and interesting and adult feeling to watch somebody get shot in the stomach, but you only have two parents, and if you miss your time with them now, you won't get another chance. I'll admit it, I'm a mess. I will tell you, because I want to tell someone, even though you never told me why you got fired, that I was fired for sleeping with my boss's wife. So what do you think I have to say to these people? What do you think my little Sunday chats with Mom are like these days? You owe me $20,500. How's that for a debt? Buy the fucking ticket. I'll reimburse you. I love you and I miss you. Don't ask me why. From Denise3 at cheapnet.com to xprof@gaddisfly.com, subject, remorse. I'm sorry I flamed you. The last line is the only one I meant. I don't have the right temperament for email. Please write back. Please come for Christmas. From Denise3 at cheapnet.com to xprof@gaddisfly.com. Subject, worry. Please, please, please don't talk about people getting shot and then do the silence thing to me. From Denise3 at cheapnet.com to xprof@gaddisfly.com. Subject, only six more shopping days before Christmas. Chip, are you there? Please write or call. Global warming enhances value of Lithuania Incorporated. Vilnius, October 30th. With world ocean levels rising by more than an inch per year and millions of cubic meters of ocean beach eroded daily, the European Council on Natural Resources this week warned that Europe could face catastrophic shortages of sand and gravel by the end of the decade. Throughout history, mankind has regarded sand and gravel as inexhaustible resources, said ECNR Chairman Jacques Dormont. Sadly, our over-reliance on greenhouse gas-producing fossil fuels will leave many Central European countries, including Germany, at the mercy of sand and gravel cartel states, particularly sand-rich Lithuania, if they wish to continue with basic road building and construction. Gitanas R. Misevičius, founder and CEO of Lithuania's Free Market Party company, compared the impending European sand and gravel crisis to the oil crisis of 1973. Back then, Misevičius said, tiny oil-rich countries like Bahrain and Brunei were the mice that roared. Tomorrow, Lithuania. Chairman Dormont described the pro-Western, pro-business Free Market Party company as currently the only political movement in Lithuania willing to deal fairly and responsibly with Western capital markets. Our misfortune, Dormont said, is that most of Europe's reserve sand and gravel capacity is in the hands of Baltic nationalists beside whom Muammar Gaddafi looks like Charles de Gaulle. I scarcely exaggerate in saying that the future economic stability of the EC is in the hands of a few brave Eastern capitalists like Mr. Misevičius. The beauty of the Internet was that Chip could post whole cloth fabrications without troubling to check even his spelling. Reliability on the web was 98% a function of how slick and cool your site looked. Although Chip personally wasn't fluent in web, he was an American under 40, and Americans under 40 were exquisite judges of what was slick and cool and what was not. He and Gitanas went to a pub called Prie Universiteto and hired five young Lithuanians in Fish and R.A.M. t-shirts for $30 a day, plus millions of worthless stock options, and for a month, Chip rode these slang-slinging webheads mercilessly. He made them study American sites like NBCI.com and Oracle. He told them to do it like this, to make it look like this. Lithuania.com was officially launched on November 5th. A high-res banner, Democracy Pays Handsome Dividends, unfurled to the accompaniment of 16 joyful bars of The Dance of the Coachmen and Grooms in Petrushka. Side by side, in a rich blue graphical space below the banner, were a black and white before picture, Socialist Vilnius, of shell-scarred facades and shattered lindens on the Gedimino Prospektas, and a luscious color after photograph, Free Market Vilnius, of a honey-lit harbor-side development of boutiques and bistros. The development was actually in Denmark. For a week, Chip and Gitanas had stayed up late drinking beer and composing the other pages, which promised investors the various eponyms and inseminatory privileges from Gitanas's original bitter posting, and also, according to the level of financial commitment, timeshares in ministerial beachside villas at Palanga, pro-rata mineral rights and logging rights to all national park lands, appointment of selected local magistrates and judges, blanket 24-hour-a-day parking privileges in perpetuity in the old city of Vilnius, 50% discount on selected rentals of Lithuanian national troops and armaments on a sign-up basis except during wartime, no-hassle adoptions of Lithuanian girl babies, discretionary immunity from left-turn-on-red prohibitions, inclusion of the investor's likeness on commemorative stamps, collector's item coins, microbrewery beer labels, bas-relief chocolate-covered Lithuanian cookies, heroic leader trading cards, printed wrapping tissue for holiday clementines, etc. Honorary Doctorate of Humane Letters from Vilnius University, founded in 1578. No questions asked access to wiretaps and other state security apparatus. The legally enforceable right, whilst on Lithuanian soil, to such titles and honorifics as Your Lordship and Your Ladyship and Your Grace, with non-use by service personnel punishable by public flogging and up to 60 days in jail. Last-minute bumping privileges for train and plane seats, reserved seating cultural events, and table reservations at participating five-star restaurants and nightclubs. Top-of-the-list priority for liver, heart, and cornea transplants at Vilnius's famed Antakalnis Hospital. No-limit hunting and fishing licenses, plus off-season privileges in national game reserves. Your name in block letters on the side of large boats, etc., etc. The lesson that Gitanas had learned and that Chip was now learning was that the more patently satirical the promises, the lustier the influx of American capital. Day after day, Chip churned out press releases, make-believe financial statements, earnest tracts arguing the Hegelian inevitability of a nakedly commercial politics, gushing eyewitness accounts of Lithuania's boom economy in the making, slow-pitch questions in online investment chat rooms, and line-drive home-run answers. If he got flame for his lies or his ignorance, he simply moved to another chat room. He wrote text for the stock certificates and for the accompanying brochure. Congratulations, you are now a free market patriot of Lithuania, and had them sumptuously printed on cotton-rich stock. He felt as if, finally, here in the realm of pure fabrication, he'd found his métier. Exactly as Melissa Paquette had promised him long ago, it was a gas to start a company, a gas to see the money flowing in. A reporter for USA Today emailed to ask, "Is this for real?" Chip emailed back, "It's for real. The for-profit nation-state with a globally dispersed citizenry of shareholders is the next stage in the evolution of political economy. Enlightened neo-techno-feudalism is blossoming in Lithuania. Come see for yourself. I can guarantee you a minimum 90 minutes FaceTime with G. Misevicius." There was no reply from USA Today. Chip worried that he'd overplayed his hand, but weekly gross receipts were topping $40,000. The money came in the form of bank drafts, credit card numbers, e-cash encryption keys, wire transfers to Credit Suisse, and $100 bills in airmail envelopes. Gitanas plowed much of the money into his ancillary enterprises, but per agreement he did double Chip's salary as profits rose. Chip was living rent-free in the stucco villa where the commander of the Soviet garrison had once eaten pheasants and drunk Gewürztraminers and chatted with Moscow on secure phone links. The villa had been stoned and looted and tagged with triumphant graffiti in the fall of 1990 and had then stood derelict until the VIPPPAKJRIINPB17 was voted out of power and Gitanas was recalled from the UN. Gitanas had been attracted to the shattered villa by its unbeatable price. It was free. By its outstanding security arrangements, including an armored tower and a U.S. Embassy-quality fence, and by the opportunity to sleep in the bedroom of the very commander who'd had him tortured for 6 months in the old Soviet barracks next door. Gitanas and other party members had worked weekends with trowels and scrapers to restore the villa, but the party had disbanded altogether before the job was finished. Now half the rooms stood vacant, the floors splashed with broken glass. As throughout the old city, heat and hot water originated at a mammoth central boiler facility and dissipated much vigor in the long trip via buried pipes and leaky risers to the showers and radiators of the villa. Gitanas had set up offices for the Free Market Party Company in the former Grand Ballroom, claimed the master bedroom for himself, installed Chip in the former aide-de-camp's suite on the third floor, and let the young webheads crash where they pleased. Although Chip was still paying the rent on his New York apartment and the monthly minimum on his visa bills, he felt agreeably affluent in Vilnius. He ordered from the top of menus, shared his booze and cigarettes with those less fortunate, and never looked at the prices in the natural food store near the university where he bought his groceries. True to Gitanas's word, there were plenty of underage girls in heavy makeup available at the bars and pizzerias, but by leaving New York and escaping from the Academy Purple, Chip seemed to have lost his need to fall in love with adolescent strangers. Twice a week, he and Gitanas visited the Club Metropole and, after a massage and before a sauna, had their needs efficiently gratified on the Metropole's indifferently clean foam cushions. Most of the Metropole's female clinicians were in their 30s and led daytime lives that revolved around child care or parent care or the university's international journalism program or the making of art in political hues that nobody would buy. Chip was surprised by how willing these women were while they dressed and fixed their hair to speak to him like a human being. He was struck by how much pleasure they seemed to take in their daytime lives, how blah their night work was by contrast, how altogether meaningless. And since he himself had begun to take active pleasure in his daytime work, he became, with each therapeutic transaction on the massage mat, a little more adept at putting his body in its place, at putting sex in its place, at understanding what love was and wasn't. With each prepaid ejaculation, he rid himself of another ounce of the hereditary shame that had resisted 15 years of sustained theoretical attack. What remained was a gratitude that he expressed in the form of 200% tips. At 2 or 3 in the morning, when the city lay oppressed by a darkness that seemed to have fallen weeks earlier, he and Gitanas returned to the villa through high sulfur smoke and snow, or fog, or drizzle. Gitanas was Chip's real love in Vilnius. Chip particularly liked how much Gitanas liked him. Everywhere the two men went, people asked if they were brothers. But the truth was that Chip felt less like a sibling of Gitanas than like his girlfriend. He felt much like Julia, perpetually feted, lavishly treated, and almost wholly dependent on Gitanas for favors and guidance and basic necessities. He sang for his supper, like Julia. He was a valued employee, a vulnerable and delightful American, an object of amusement and indulgence and even mystery. And what a great pleasure it was for a change, to be the pursued one, to have qualities and attributes that somebody else so wanted. All in all, he found Vilnius a lovely world of braised beef and cabbage and potato pancakes, of beer and vodka and tobacco, of comradeship, subversive enterprise, and pussy. He liked a climate and a latitude that substantially dispensed with daylight. He could sleep extremely late and still rise with the sun, and very soon after breakfast the time came for an evening pick-me-up of coffee and a cigarette. His was partly a student life, He'd always loved a student life, and partly a life in the fast lane of dot-com startups. From a distance of 4,000 miles, everything he'd left behind in the U.S. looked manageably small. His parents, his debts, his failures, his loss of Julia. He felt so much better on the work front and sex front and friendship front that for a while he forgot what misery tasted like. He resolved to stay in Vilnius until he'd earned enough money to pay down his debts to Denise and to his credit card issuers. He believed that as few as 6 months would suffice for this. How wholly typical it was of his luck, then, that before he could enjoy even 2 good months in Vilnius, both his father and Lithuania fell apart. Denise, in her emails, had been hectoring Chip about Alfred's health and insisting that Chip come to St. Jude for Christmas, but a trip home in December held little attraction. He suspected that if he abandoned the villa, even for a week, something stupid would prevent him from returning. A spell would be broken, a magic lost. But Denise, who was the steadiest person he knew, finally sent him an email in which she sounded downright desperate. Chip skimmed the message before he realized that he shouldn't have looked at it at all because it named the sum he owed her. The misery, whose taste he thought he'd forgotten, the troubles that had seemed small from a distance, filled his head again. He deleted the email and immediately regretted it. He had a dreamlike semi-memory of the phrase, "fired for sleeping with my boss's wife." But this was such an unlikely phrase coming from Denise, and his eye had brushed over it so quickly that he couldn't fully credit the memory. If his sister was on her way out as a lesbian, which, come to think of it, would make sense of several aspects of Denise that had always puzzled him, then she could certainly now use the support of her Foucauldian older brother. But Chip wasn't ready to go home yet. And so he assumed that his memory had deceived him and that her phrase had referred to something else. He smoked 3 cigarettes, dissolving his anxiety in rationalizations and counter-accusations and a fresh resolve to stay in Lithuania until he could pay his sister the $20,500 that he owed her. If Alfred lived with Denise until June, this meant that Chip could stay in Lithuania for another 6 months and still keep his promise of an all-family reunion in Philadelphia. Lithuania, unfortunately, was rattling down the road toward anarchy. Through October and November, despite the global financial crisis, a veneer of normalcy had adhered to Vilnius. Farmers still brought to market poultry and livestock for which they were paid in lite that they then spent on Russian gasoline, on domestic beer and vodka, on stonewashed jeans and Spice Girls sweatshirts, on pirated X-Files videos imported from economies even sicker than Lithuania's. The truckers who distributed the gasoline, and the workers who distilled the vodka, and the kerchiefed old women who sold the Spice Girls sweatshirts out of wooden carts, all bought the farmers' beef and chicken. The land produced, the lite circulated, and in Vilnius at least, the pubs and clubs stayed open late. But the economy wasn't simply local. You could give lite to the Russian petroleum exporter who supplied your country with gasoline, but this exporter was within his rights to ask which Lithuanian goods or services exactly he might care to spend his lite on. It was easy to buy lite at the official rate of 4 per dollar. Hard, however, to buy a dollar for 4 lite. In a familiar paradox of depression, goods became scarce because there were no buyers. The harder it was to find aluminum foil or ground beef or motor oil, the more tempting it became to hijack truckloads of these commodities or to muscle in on their distribution. Meanwhile, public servants, notably the police, continued to draw fixed salaries of irrelevant lite. The underground economy soon learned to price a precinct captain as unerringly as it priced a box of light bulbs. Chip was struck by the broad similarities between black market Lithuania and free market America. In both countries, wealth was concentrated in the hands of a few. Any meaningful distinction between private and public sectors had disappeared. Captains of commerce lived in a ceaseless anxiety that drove them to expand their empires ruthlessly. Ordinary citizens lived in ceaseless fear of being fired and ceaseless confusion about which powerful private interest owned which formerly public institution on any given day. And the economy was fueled largely by the elite's insatiable demand for luxury. In Vilnius, by November of that dismal autumn, 5 criminal oligarchs were responsible for employing thousands of carpenters, bricklayers, craftsmen, cooks, prostitutes, barkeeps, auto mechanics, and bodyguards. The main difference between America and Lithuania, as far as Chip could see, was that in America, the wealthy few subdued the unwealthy many by means of mind-numbing and soul-killing entertainments and gadgetry and pharmaceuticals. Whereas in Lithuania, the powerful few subdued the unpowerful many by threatening violence. It warmed his Foucauldian heart, in a way, to live in a land where property ownership and the control of public discourse were so obviously a matter of who had the guns. The Lithuanian with the most guns was an ethnic Russian named Viktor Lichenkov, who had parlayed the cash liquidity of his heroin and ecstasy near monopoly into absolute control of the Bank of Lithuania after the bank's previous owner, Friend Lee Trust of Atlanta, had catastrophically misjudged consumer appetite for its Dilbert MasterCards. Viktor Lichenkov's cash reserves enabled him to arm a 500-man private constabulary, which in October boldly surrounded the Chernobyl-type nuclear reactor at Ignalina, 120 kilometers northeast of Vilnius, that supplied three-quarters of the nation's electricity. The siege gave Lichenkov excellent leverage in negotiating his purchase of the country's largest utility from the rival oligarch who himself had bought it on the cheap during the Great Privatization. Overnight, Lichenkov gained control of every Litas flowing from every electric meter in the country, but fearing that his Russian heritage might provoke nationalist animosity, he took care not to abuse his new power. As a gesture of goodwill, he slashed electricity prices by the 15% that the previous oligarch had been overcharging. On the resulting wave of popularity, he chartered a new political party, the Cheap Power for the People Party, and fielded a slate of parliamentary candidates for the mid-December national elections. And still, the land produced and the lite circulated. A slasher flick called Moody Fruit opened at the Lietuva and the Vingis. Lithuanian drolleries issued from Jennifer Aniston's mouth on Friends. City workers emptied concrete-clad garbage receptacles on the square outside St. Catherine's. But every day was darker and shorter than the day before. As a global player, Lithuania had been fading since the death of Vytautas the Great in 1430. For 600 years, the country was passed around among Poland, Prussia, and Russia like a much recycled wedding present, the leatherette ice bucket, the salad tongs. The country's language and a memory of better times survived, but the main fact about Lithuania was that it wasn't very large. In the 20th century, the Gestapo and SS could liquidate 200,000 Lithuanian Jews, and the Soviets could deport another 250,000 citizens to Siberia without attracting undue international attention. Gitanas Misevičius came from a family of priests and soldiers and bureaucrats near the Bielorussian border. His paternal grandfather, a local judge, had failed a Q&A session with the new communist administrators in 1940 and had been sent to the Gulag along with his wife and never heard from again. Gitanas's father owned a pub in Vidiskas and gave aid and comfort to the partisan resistance movement, the so-called Forest Brothers, until hostilities ceased in 1953. A year after Gitanas was born, Vidiskas and 8 surrounding municipalities were emptied by the puppet government to clear the way for the first of 2 nuclear power plants. The 15,000 people thus displaced, for reasons of safety, were offered housing in a brand-new, fully modern small city, Khrushchevai, that had been erected hastily in the lake country west of Ignalina. "Kind of bleak-looking, all cinder block, no trees," Gitanas told Chip. My dad's new pub had a cinderblock bar, cinderblock booths, cinderblock shelves. The socialist planned economy in Byelorussia had made too many cinderblocks and was giving them away for nothing. Or so we were told. Anyway, we all move in. We got our cinderblock beds and our cinderblock playground equipment and our cinderblock park benches. The years go by, I'm 10 years old, and suddenly everybody's mom or dad's got lung cancer. I mean everybody's. Well, and then my dad's got a lung tumor, and finally the authorities come and take a look at Khrushcheva, and lo and behold, we got a radon problem. Serious radon problem. Really fucking disastrous radon problem, actually. Because it turns out those cinder blocks are mildly radioactive. And radon is pooling in every closed room in Khrushcheva. Especially rooms like a pub, with not a lot of air, where the owner sits all day and smokes cigarettes. Like, for instance, my dad does. Well, Byelorussia, which is our sister socialist republic, and which, by the way, we Lithuanians used to own, Byelorussia says it's really sorry. There must have somehow been some pitch blend in those cinder blocks, says Byelorussia. Big mistake. Sorry, sorry, sorry. So we all move out of Khrushcheva, and my dad dies, horribly, at 10 minutes after midnight on the day after his wedding anniversary, because he doesn't want my mom remembering his death on their wedding date. And then 30 years go by, and Gorbachev steps down, and finally we get to take a look in those old archives, and what do you know? There was no weird glut of cinder block due to poor planning. There was no snafu in the 5-year plan. There was a deliberate strategy of recycling very low-grade nuclear waste in building materials. On the theory that the cement in cinder block renders the radioisotopes harmless. But the Byelorussians had Geiger counters, and that was the end of that happy dream of harmlessness. And so 1,000 trainloads of cinder block got sent to us, who had no reason to suspect that anything was wrong. Ouch, Chip said. It's beyond ouch, Gitana said. It killed my dad when I was 11, and my best friend's dad, and hundreds of other people over the years, and everything made sense. There was always an enemy with a big red target on his back. There was a big, evil daddy USSR that we all could hate, until the '90s. The platform of the VIPPPAKJRIINPB-17, which Gitanas helped found after independence, consisted of one very broad and heavy plank. The Soviets must pay for raping Lithuania. For a while, in the '90s, it was possible to run the country on pure hatred. But soon other parties emerged with platforms which, while giving revanchism its due, also sought to move beyond it. By the end of the '90s, after the VIPPPAKJRIINPB-17 lost its last seat in the Seimas, all that remained of the party was its half-renovated villa. Gitanas tried to make political sense of the world around him and could not. The world had made sense when the Red Army was illegally detaining him, asking him questions that he refused to answer, and slowly covering the left side of his body with third-degree burns. After independence, though, politics had lost its coherence. Even as simple and vital an issue as Soviet reparations to Lithuania was bedeviled by the fact that during World War II, the Lithuanians themselves had helped persecute the Jews, and by the fact that many of the people now running the Kremlin were themselves former anti-Soviet patriots who deserved reparations nearly as much as the Lithuanians did. "What do I do now?" Gitanas asked Chip, "when the invader is a system and a culture, not an army. The best future I can hope now for my country is that someday it looks more like a second-rate country in the West, more like everybody else, in other words. More like Denmark, with its attractive harborside bistros and boutiques," Chip said. "How Lithuanian we all felt," Gitanas said, "when we could point to the Soviets and say, 'No, we're not like that.' But to say, 'No, we are not free market, no, we are not globalized,' this doesn't make me feel Lithuanian. This makes me feel stupid and Stone Age. So how do I be a patriot now? What positive thing do I stand for? What is the positive definition of my country?" Gitanas continued to reside in the semi-derelict villa. He offered the aide-de-camp suite to his mother, but she preferred to stay in her apartment outside Ignalina. as was de rigueur for all Lithuanian officials of that era, especially for revanchists like himself, he acquired a piece of formerly communist property, a 20% stake in Sucrosas, the beet sugar refinery that was Lithuania's second largest single-site employer, and lived fairly comfortably as a retired patriot on the dividends. For a time, like Chip, Gitanas glimpsed salvation in the person of Julia Vrace. In her beauty, in her American path of least resistance quest for pleasure. Then Julia ditched him on a Berlin-bound jet. Hers was the latest betrayal in a life that had come to seem a numbing parade of betrayals. He was screwed by the Soviets, screwed by the Lithuanian electorate, and screwed by Julia. Finally, he was screwed by the IMF and World Bank, and he brought a 40-year load of bitterness to the joke of Lithuania Incorporated. Hiring Chip to run the Free Market Party company was the first good decision he'd made in a long time. Gitanas had gone to New York to find a divorce lawyer and possibly to hire a cheap American actor, somebody middle-aged and failing, whom he could install in Vilnius to reassure such callers and visitors as Lithuania Incorporated might attract. He could hardly believe that a man as young and talented as Chip was willing to work for him. He was only briefly dismayed that Chip had been sleeping with his wife. In Gitanas' experience, everyone eventually betrayed him. He appreciated that Chip had accomplished his betrayal before they even met. As for Chip, the inferiority he felt in Vilnius as a pathetic American who spoke neither Lithuanian nor Russian and whose father hadn't died of lung cancer at an early age, and whose grandparents hadn't disappeared into Siberia, and who'd never been tortured for his ideals in an unheated military prison cell, was offset by his competence as an employee and by the memory of certain extremely flattering contrasts that Julia used to draw between him and Gitanas. In pubs and clubs, where the two men often didn't bother to deny that they were brothers, Chip had the sensation of being the more successful of the two. "I was a pretty good deputy prime minister," Gitanas said gloomily. "I'm not a very good criminal warlord." Warlord, indeed, was a somewhat glorified term for Gitanas's line of work. He was exhibiting signs of failure with which Chip was all too familiar. He spent an hour worrying for every minute he spent doing. Investors around the globe were sending him gaudy sums that he deposited in his Credit Suisse account every Friday afternoon, but he couldn't decide whether to use the money honestly, that is, to buy seats in Parliament for the Free Market Party company, or to commit fraud unabashedly and pour his ill-gotten hard currency into even less legitimate businesses. For a while he sort of did both and sort of did neither. Finally, his market research, which he conducted by quizzing drunken strangers in bars, persuaded him that in the current economic climate, even a Bolshevik had a better chance of attracting votes than a party with free market in its name. Abandoning any notion of staying legit, Gitanas hired bodyguards. Soon, Viktor Lichenkov asked his spies, "Why is this has-been patriot, Misevicius, bothering with protection?" Gitanas had been far safer as an undefended has-been patriot than he was as the commander of 10 strapping Kalashnikov-toting youths. He was obliged to retain more bodyguards, and Chip, for fear of getting shot, stopped leaving the compound without an escort. "You're not in danger," Gitanas assured him. "Lichenkov might want to kill me and take over the company for himself, but you're the goose with the golden ovaries." The back of Chip's neck nonetheless prickled with vulnerability when he went out in public. On the night of Thanksgiving in America, he watched two of Lichenkov's men elbow through the crowd at a sticky-floored club called Musmirite and put 6 holes in the abdomen of a red-haired wine and spirits importer. That Lichenkov's men had walked past Chip without harming him did go to prove Gitanas's point. But the body of the wine and spirits importer looked every bit as soft in comparison to bullets as Chip had always feared a body was. Bad overloads of current flooded the dying man's nerves. violent convulsions, hidden stores of galvanic energy, immensely distressing electrochemical outcomes, had clearly lain latent in his wiring all his life. Gitanas showed up at Musmirite half an hour later. "My problem," he mused, looking at the bloodstains, "is it's easier for me to be shot than to shoot."
"There you go again, running yourself down," Chip said.
"I'm good at enduring pain, bad at inflicting it."
"Seriously, don't be so hard on yourself.
Kill or be killed. It's not an easy concept."
Gitanas had tried to be aggressive. As a criminal warlord, he did have one fine asset: the cash generated by the Free Market Party Company. After Lichenkov's forces had surrounded the Ignalina reactor and coerced the sale of Lithuanian Electric, Gitanas sold his lucrative stake in Sucrosas, emptied the coffers of the Free Market Party Company, and bought a controlling interest in the principal cellular phone service provider in Lithuania. The company, Trans-Baltic Wireless, was the only utility in his price range. He gave his bodyguards 1,000 domestic minutes per month, plus free voicemail and caller ID, and put them to work monitoring calls on Lichenkov's many Trans-Baltic cell phones. When he learned that Lichenkov was about to dump his entire position in the National Tannery and Livestock Products and Byproducts Corporation, Gitanas was able to short his own shares. The move netted him a bundle, but proved fatal in the long run. Lichenkov tipped off to the monitoring of his phones, switched service to a more secure regional system operated out of Riga. Then he turned around and attacked Gitanas. On the eve of the December 20th elections, an electrical substation accident selectively blacked out the switching center of Trans-Baltic Wireless and six of its transceiver towers. A mob of angry young Vilniusian cell phone users with shaved heads and goatees attempted to storm Trans-Baltic's offices. Trans-Baltic's management called for help on ordinary copper wire lines. The police, responding to the call, joined the mob in looting the office and laying siege to its treasury until the arrival of three vanloads of police from the only precinct that Gitanas could afford to pay off. After a pitched battle, the first group of police retreated, and the remaining police dispersed the mob. Through Friday night and into Saturday morning, the company's technical staff scrambled to repair the Brezhnev-era emergency generator that provided backup power to the switching center. The generator's main transfer bus was badly corroded, and when the senior supervisor jiggled it to test its integrity, he snapped it off at the base. Working to reattach it in the light of candles and flashlights, the supervisor then burned a hole in the primary induction coil with his welding torch. And given the political instabilities surrounding the election, there were no other gas-powered AC generators to be had at any price in Vilnius, and certainly no three-phase generators of the kind for which the switching center had been retrofitted for no better reason than that an old Brezhnev-era three-phase generator was available for cheap. And meanwhile, electrical parts suppliers in Poland and Finland were reluctant, given the political instabilities, to ship anything into Lithuania without first receiving payment in hard Western currency. And so, a country whose citizens, like so many of their Western counterparts, had simply disconnected their copper wire telephones when cell phones became cheap and universal, was plunged into a communications silence of 19th century proportions. On a very gloomy Sunday morning, Lichenkov and his slate of smugglers and hitmen on the Cheap Power for the People Party ticket claimed 38 of the 141 seats in the Seimas. But the Lithuanian president, Audrius Vitkunas, a charismatic and paranoid arch-nationalist who hated Russia and the West with equal passion, refused to certify the election results. "Hydrophobic Lichenkov and his mouth-frothing hellhounds will not intimidate me," Vitkunas shouted in a televised address on Sunday evening.
localized power failures, a near-total breakdown in the communications network of the capital and its environs, and the presence of roving, heavily armed constabularies of Lichenkov's hired mouth-frothing, lick-spittle hellhounds do not inspire confidence that yesterday's voting reflects the stubborn will and immense good sense of the great and glorious immortal Lithuanian people. I will not, I cannot, I must not, I durst not, I shall not certify these scum-flecked, maggot-riddled, tertiary syphilitic national parliamentary election results.
Itanas and Chip watched the address on the television in the former ballroom at the villa. Two bodyguards quietly played Dungeon Master in a corner of the room while Gitanas translated for Chip the richer nuggets of Vitkunasian rhetoric. The peaty light of the year's shortest day had faded in the casement windows.
"I got a real bad feeling about this," Gitanas said. "I got a feeling Lichenkov wants to gun down Vitkunas and take his chances with whoever replaces him."
Chip, who was doing his best to forget that Christmas was 4 days away, had no wish to hang on in Vilnius, only to be driven out a week after the holiday. He asked Gitanas if he'd thought about emptying the Credit Suisse account and leaving the country.
"Oh, sure."
Gitanas was wearing his red motocross jacket and hugging himself.
"I think about chopping at Bloomingdale's every day. I think about the big tree at the Rockefeller Center."
"Then what's keeping you?" Gitanas scratched his scalp and smelled his fingernails, blending the aroma of scalp with the skin oil smells from around his nose, taking obvious comfort in sebum.
"If I leave," he said, "and the trouble blows over, then where am I? I'm fucked three ways. I'm not employable in America. As of next month, I'm not married to an American. And my mom's in Ignalina. What do I got in New York?"
"We could run this thing in New York.
They got laws there. They'd shut us down in a week. I'm fucked three ways."
Toward midnight, Chip went upstairs and inserted himself between his thin, cold, East Block sheets. His room smelled of damp plaster, cigarettes, and strong synthetic shampoo fragrances such as pleased the Baltic nose. His mind was aware of its own racing. He didn't fall into sleep, but skipped off it, again and again, like a stone on water. He kept mistaking the streetlight in his window for the light of day. He went downstairs and realized that it was already late afternoon on Christmas Eve. He had the oversleeper's panicked sense of having fallen behind, of lacking information. His mother was making Christmas Eve dinner in the kitchen. His father, youthful in a leather jacket, was sitting in the ballroom in the dim late light and watching the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather. Chip, to be friendly, asked him what the news was.
"Tell Chip," Alfred told Chip, whom he didn't recognize, "there's trouble in the East."
Real daylight came at 8. A shouting in the street woke him up. His room was cold but not freezing. A smell of warm dust came off the radiator, the city's central boiler facility still functioning, the social order still intact. Through the branches of the spruce trees outside his window, he saw a crowd of several dozen men and women in bulky overcoats milling outside the fence. A dusting of snow had fallen in the night. Two of Gitanas's security men, the brothers Jonas and Aidaris, big blonde fellows with semi-automatics on straps, were parleying through the bars of the front gate with a pair of middle-aged women whose brassy hair and red faces, like the heat in Chip's radiator, gave evidence of ordinary life's persistence. Downstairs, the ballroom echoed with emphatic televised Lithuanian declarations. Gitanas was sitting exactly where Chip had left him the night before, but his clothes were different and he appeared to have slept. The gray morning light and the snow on the trees and the peripheral sense of disarray and breakup recalled the end of an academic fall term, the last day of exams before the Christmas break. Chip went to the kitchen and poured Vitasoy Delight Vanilla Soy Milk on a bowl of Barbara's all-natural shredded oats bite-sized cereal. He drank some of the viscous German organic black cherry juice that he'd lately been enjoying. He made two mugs of instant coffee and took them to the ballroom, where Gitanas had turned off the TV and was sniffing his fingernails again. Chip asked him what the news was.
All my bodyguards ran away except Jonas and Idaris, Gitana said. They took the VW and the Lada. I doubt they're coming back.
With protectors like this, who needs attackers? Chip said.
They left us the Stomper, which is a crime magnet.
When did this happen?
Must have been right after President Vidkunas put the army on alert.
Chip laughed. When did that happen?
Early this morning. Everything in the city is apparently still functioning, except, of course, Trans-Baltic Wireless, Gitana said.
The mob in the street had swelled. There were perhaps 100 people now, holding aloft cell phones that collectively produced an eerie, angelic sound. They were playing the sequence of tones that signified service interruption.
I want you to go back to New York, Gitana said. We'll see what happens here. Maybe I'll come, maybe I won't. I gotta see my mother for Christmas. Meantime, here's your severance.
He tossed Chip a thick brown envelope, just as multiple thuds were sounding on the villa's outer walls. Chip dropped the envelope. A rock crashed through a window and bounced to a stop by the television set. The rock was four-sided, a broken corner of granite cobblestone. It was coated with fresh hostility, and seemed faintly embarrassed. Gitanas dialed the police on the copper wire line and spoke wearily. The brothers Jonas and Idaris, fingers on triggers, came in through the front door, followed by cold air with a sprucy Yule flavor. The brothers were cousins of Gitanas. This was presumably why they hadn't deserted with the others. Gitanas put down the phone and conferred with them in Lithuanian. The brown envelope contained a meaty stack of $50 and $100 bills. Chip's feeling from his dream, his belated realization that the holiday had come, was persisting in the daylight. None of the young webheads had reported to work today, and now Gitanas had given him a present, and snow was clinging to the boughs of spruces, and carolers in bulky coats were at the gate.
"Pack your bags," Gitanas said. "Jonas will take you to the airport."
Chip went upstairs with an empty head and heart. He heard guns banging on the front porch, the tingling of ejected casings, Jonas and Idaris firing, he hoped, at the sky. Jingle bells, jingle bells. He put on his leather pants and leather coat. Repacking his bag connected him to the moment of unpacking it in early October, completed a loop of time, and pulled a drawstring that made the 12 intervening weeks disappear. Here he was again, packing. Gitanas was smelling his fingers, his eyes on the news, when Chip returned to the ballroom. Viktor Luchenkov's mustaches went up and down on the TV screen.
"What's he saying?"
Gitanas shrugged.
"That Vidkunas is mentally unfit, etc. That Vidkunas is mounting a putsch to reverse the legitimate will of the Lithuanian people, etc."
"You should come with me," Chip said.
"I'm gonna go see my mother," Gitanas said. "I'll call you next week."
Chip put his arms around his friend and squeezed him. He could smell the scalp oils that Gitanas, in his agitation, had been sniffing. He felt as if he were hugging himself, feeling his own primate shoulder blades, the scratch of his own woolen sweater. He also felt his friend's gloom. How not there he was, how distracted or shut down. And it made him, too, feel lost. Jonas beeped the horn on the gravel drive outside the front door.
"Let's meet up in New York," Chip said.
"Okay, maybe."
Gitanas pulled away and wandered back to the television. Only a few stragglers remained to throw rocks at the Stomper as Jonas and Chip roared through the open gate. They drove south out of the city center on a street lined with forbidding gas stations and brown-walled, traffic-scarred buildings that seemed happiest and most themselves on days like this one when the weather was raw and the light was poor. Jonas spoke very little English but managed to exude tolerance toward Chip, if not friendliness, while keeping his eyes on the rearview mirror. Traffic was extremely sparse this morning, and sport utility vehicles, those workhorses of the warlord class, attracted unhealthy attention in times of instability. The little airport was mobbed with young people speaking the languages of the West.
since the Quad Cities Fund had liquidated Lietuvos Avialinios, other airlines had taken over some of the routes, but the curtailed flight schedule, 14 departures a day for a capital of Europe, wasn't equipped to handle loads like today's. Hundreds of British, German, and American students and entrepreneurs, many of their faces familiar to Chip from his pub crawling with Gitanas, had converged on the reservation counters of Finnair and Lufthansa, Aeroflot and LOT Polish Airlines. Doughty city buses were arriving with fresh loads of foreign nationals. As far as Chip could see, none of the counter lines were moving at all. He tallied the flights on the outbound board and chose the airline Finnair with the most departures. At the end of the very long Finnair line were two American college girls in bell-bottom jeans and other 60s revival wear. The names on their luggage were Tiffany and Cheryl. "Do you have tickets?" Chip asked. "For tomorrow," Tiffany said. "But things looked kind of nasty, so..." "Is this line moving?" "I don't know. We've only been here 10 minutes.
"It hasn't moved in 10 minutes?
"There's only one person at the counter," Tiffany said. "But it's not like there's some other better Finnair counter someplace else, so..." Chip was feeling disoriented and had to steel himself not to hail a cab and return to Gitanas. Cheryl said to Tiffany, "So my dad's like, 'You've got a sublet if you're going to Europe,' and I'm like, 'I promised Anna she could stay there weekends when there's home games so she can sleep with Jason, right? I can't take a promise back, right? But my dad's getting, like, all bottom line, and I'm like, hello, it's my condominium, right? You bought it for me, right? I didn't know I was going to have some stranger, you know, who, like, fries things on the stove and sleeps in my bed.'" Tiffany said, "That is so gross." Cheryl said, "And uses my pillows?" Two more non-Lithuanians, a pair of Belgians, joined the line behind Chip. Simply not to be the last in line brought some relief. Chip, in French, asked the Belgians to watch his bag and hold his place. He went to the men's room, locked himself in a stall, and counted the money Gitanas had given him. It was $29,250. It upset him somehow. It made him afraid. A voice on a bathroom speaker announced, in Lithuanian and then Russian and then English, that LOT Polish Airlines flight number 331 from Warsaw had been cancelled. Chip put 20 hundreds in his T-shirt pocket, 20 hundreds in his left boot, and returned the rest of the money to the envelope, which he hid inside his T-shirt against his belly. He wished that Gitanas hadn't given him the money. Without money, he'd had a good reason to stay in Vilnius. Now that he had no good reason, a simple fact which the previous 12 weeks had kept hidden was stripped naked in the fecal Uruk bathroom stall. The simple fact was that he was afraid to go home. No man likes to see his cowardice as clearly as Chip could see his now. He was angry at the money and angry at Gitanas for giving it to him and angry at Lithuania for falling apart. But the fact remained that he was afraid to go home. And this was nobody's fault but his. He reclaimed his place in the Finnair line, which hadn't moved at all. Airport speakers were announcing the cancellation of flight number 1048 from Helsinki. A collective groan went up, and bodies surged forward, the head of the line blunting itself against the counter like a delta. Cheryl and Tiffany kicked their bags forward. Chip kicked his bag forward. He felt returned to the world, and he didn't like it. A kind of hospital light, a light of seriousness and inescapability, fell on the girls and the baggage and the Finnair personnel in their uniforms. Chip had nowhere to hide. Everyone around him was reading a novel. He hadn't read a novel in at least a year. The prospect frightened him nearly as much as the prospect of Christmas and St. Jude. He wanted to go out and hail a cab, but he suspected that Gitanas had already fled the city. He stood in the hard light until the hour was 2, and then 2:30, early morning in St. Jude. While the Belgians watched his bag again, he waited in a different line and made a credit card phone call. Enid's voice was slurred and tiny.
"Hello?"
"Hi, Mom, it's me." Her voice trebled instantly in pitch and volume.
"Chip? Oh, Chip, Al, it's Chip, it's Chip! Chip, where are you?"
I'm at the airport in Vilnius. I'm on my way home.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Now tell me, when do you get here?
I don't have a ticket yet, he said. Things are sort of falling apart here, but tomorrow afternoon sometime, Wednesday at the latest.
Wonderful.
He hadn't been prepared for the joy in his mother's voice. If he'd ever known that he could bring joy to another person, he'd long since forgotten it. He took care to steady his own voice and keep his word count low. He said that he would call again as soon as he was at a better airport.
This is wonderful news, Enid said. I'm so happy.
Okay, then, I'll see you soon. Already the great Baltic winter night was shouldering in from the north. Veterans from the front of the Finnair line reported that the rest of the day's flights were sold out and that at least one of these flights was likely to be cancelled, but Chip hoped that by flashing a couple of hundreds he could secure those bumping privileges that he'd lampooned on Lithuania.com. Failing that, he would buy somebody's ticket for lots of cash. Cheryl said,
"Oh, my God, Tiffany, the Stairmaster is so totally butt-building."
Tiffany said,
"Only if you, like, stick it out."
Cheryl said, "Everybody sticks it out. You can't help it. Your legs get tired." Tiffany said,
"Duh, it's a Stairmaster. Your legs are supposed to get tired."
Cheryl looked out a window and asked with withering undergraduate disdain,
"Excuse me, why is there a tank in the middle of the runway?"
A minute later, the lights went out and the phones went dead. One last Christmas. Down in the basement, at the eastern end of the ping-pong table, Alfred was unpacking a Maker's Mark whiskey carton filled with Christmas tree lights. He already had prescription drugs and an enema kit on the table. He had a sugar cookie freshly baked by Enid in a shape suggestive of a terrier but meant to be a reindeer. He had a log cabin syrup carton containing the large colored lights that he'd formerly hung on the outdoor ewes. He had a pump-action shotgun in a zippered canvas case and a box of 20-gauge shells. He had rare clarity and the will to use it while it lasted. A shadowy light of late afternoon was captive in the window wells. The furnace was cycling on often, the house leaking heat. Alfred's red sweater hung on him in skewed folds and bulges, as if he were a log or a chair. His gray wool slacks were afflicted with stains that he had no choice but to tolerate because the only other option was to take leave of his senses, and he wasn't quite ready to do that. Uppermost in the Maker's Mark carton was a very long string of white Christmas lights coiled bulkily around a wand of cardboard. The string stank of mildew from the storeroom beneath the porch, and when he put the plug into an outlet, he could see right away that all was not well. Most of the lights were burning brightly, but near the center of the spool was a patch of unlit bulbs, a substantia nigra deep inside the tangle. He unwound the spool with veering hands.